to be considered. I explored another possibility. Just before I saw my huge monster, I'd been closely inspecting in the rock pool a little monster, the red bristling worm whose 5 or 6 inches of wriggling body appeared big in the confined space of the pool. Was it possible that through some purely optical mechanism, some unusual trick of the retina, I had thrown the image of the worm out onto the surface of the sea? This was an interesting idea, but totally implausible, since the red worm bore no resemblance to the bluish, blackish monster, except insofar as both of them had wreathed into coils. Besides, I had never heard of any such retinal cinematography. I was struck, on reflection, by the fact that I recalled the creature with extreme clarity. The visual impression remained extremely detailed, while at the same time I felt more and more vague about its exact distance away from me. The solution, which I now think to be the most probable, though whether I shall continue to think so remains to be seen, is this, and I record it with a little shame. I am neither a drunkard nor a drug addict. I scarcely ever drink spirits. I have smoked hash occasionally in America. However, on one occasion, several years ago, I was idiot enough to take a dose of LSD. I did it to please a woman. I had what is known as a bad trip. It was a very bad trip. I shall not attempt to describe what I experienced on that dreadful and rather shameful occasion. I will only add it concerned entrails. In fact, it would be extremely hard, even impossible, to put it properly into words. It was something morally, spiritually horrible, as if one's stinking inside had emerged and become the universe, a surging emanation of dark, half-formed spiritual evil, something never ever to be escaped from. Undetachable, I remember, was a word which somehow came along with the impression of it. In fact, the visual images involved were dreadfully clear and, as it were, authoritative ones, and they are rising up in front of me at this moment, and I will not write about them. Of course, I never took LSD again. I had no further after-effects, and after a while I began mercifully to forget the experience in the quite special way in which one forgets a dream. However, it is possible, perhaps plausible, to conjecture that the sea monster which I saw was a hallucination which was also caused by my one foolish experiment with that awful drug. It is true that the rising, coiling monster did not really resemble what I saw on the first occasion, any more than it resembled the red worm in the pool, but the feeling of horror was similar in quality, or at any rate began to seem so very soon after the experience itself. Also, the quality of the tendency to forget also now seems to me to be similar in the two cases. A bad trip can recur in this way, I am told. Readers be warned. However, it must be admitted that as I reflect about it all at this moment, the strongest evidence for this explanation is the total implausibility of all the others. My heart is beating violently again. I must go to bed. Perhaps I should have waited until tomorrow morning to tell this story. I shall take a sleeping pill. 2 days have passed since I wrote the above. I slept well after writing about my monster, and I still think my explanation is the right one. Anyway, he recedes and the horror has gone away. Perhaps it did me good to write it all down. I have decided that the footsteps in the attics are rats. Another sunny day. Still no letters. I swam again at the little stony beach, and although the sea was fairly calm, I had the same irritating difficulty getting out of it. I had to climb a steep bank of tumbling, shifting pebbles, while each successive wave was submerging me from behind. Swallowed a lot of water, and cut my foot. Found my abandoned pile of driftwood and carried it home. Felt very chilled, but too tired to organize hip bath, which seems to be made of cast iron. Not worth carrying hot water up to bathroom. It has occurred to me that if I attach a rope to the iron banister at the tower steps, I could use the steps even in rough weather. And if I could find anything to tie it to, I could dangle a rope over my cliff to help me out of the water there. I must see if the village shop sells rope. I must also find out where I can get more cylinders of Calagas. My paternal grandfather was a market gardener in Lincolnshire. There, quite suddenly, I have started to write my autobiography, and what a splendid opening sentence. I knew it would happen if I just waited. He lived in a house called Shaxton. I thought it was very distinguished to have a house with a name. I do not know what my maternal grandfather did. He died when I was a small child. I think he worked in an office, as indeed my father did, too. Doubtless he was some sort of clerk, as indeed my father was, too, I suppose, though we never used the word clerk at home. My paternal grandfather had two sons, Adam and Abel. He never seemed to me to be an imaginative man, but there was some touch of poetry in those names. It was early evident to me that my uncle, Abel, was more loved and more fortunate than my father, Adam. How does a child perceive such things? Or rather, how is it that they are so perceptible, so obvious to a child who, perhaps, like a dog, reads signs which have become invisible amid the conventions of the grown-up world and are thus overlooked in the adult campaign of deceit? I knew that my father, who was the slightly elder of the two, was some sort of luckless failure before I knew what failure meant, before I knew anything about money, status, power, fame, or any of those coveted prizes whose myriad forms have led me throughout my life, that dervish dance which is now, I trust, over. And, of course, when I say that my dear father was a failure, I mean it only in the grossest, worldly sense. He was an intelligent, good man, pure in heart. My maternal grandparents lived in Carlisle, and I scarcely knew them. My mother's sisters figured as two pale aunties, also in Carlisle. My paternal grandmother died young, and in my memories of Shaxton she appears as a photograph. Indeed, my grandfather, whom I disliked and feared, appears to me now only as Wellington boots and a loud voice. Adam and Abel crowded my childhood world, dominating it like twin gods. My mother was a separate force, always separate. And then, of course, there was my cousin James, who, like me, was an only child. The ways of the brothers parted. My father drifted into Warwickshire and worked in local government. Drifted. I see him on a raft. Uncle Abel became a successful barrister in Lincoln and lived in a house in the country called Ramsden's, another distinguished place with a name. Ramsden's was larger than Shaxton. I still see both those houses in my dreams. Later on, the Uncle Abels moved to London but kept Ramsden's as what they called their country cottage. Uncle Abel married a rich, pretty American girl called Estelle. I remember her being referred to by my mother as an heiress. My father married my mother, who was working as a secretary on a farm. Her name was Marion. He called her Maid Marion. She was a strict evangelical Christian. My father was a Christian too, of course. So was I. So was Uncle Abel, until Aunt Estelle took him away into the world of light. I cannot see my mother as a lovely girl, as the Maid Marion of the Warwickshire lanes. I see her face, in my earliest memories, as a mask of anxiety. She was the strong one. My father and I loved and obeyed and comforted each other in secret. Well, we all three loved and comforted each other. We were poorish and lonely and awkward together. I was utterly horrified in the kitchen this morning to see what I took to be a grotesquely huge, fat, fleshy spider emerging from the larder. It turned out to be a most engaging toad. I caught him easily and carried him across the wood to the mossy, boggy pools beyond the rocks. Here he ambled away. How can such gentle, defenceless animals survive? I lingered for a little while after the toad had gone and looked at the red-tufted mosses and the flowers, mare's tails, which I remember from my youth, and that weird yellow flower that catches flies. Heather grows upon the higher ground inland, towards Amorn Farm. I was told by the house agent that there are orchids in the vicinity, but I have seen none. Perhaps they are as legendary as the seals. Later on I went into the village to buy deep-freeze kipper fillets, the poor man's smoked salmon. Of course, it is quite impossible to buy fresh fish here, as all the villagers tell me with pride. I also made some rather inconclusive inquiries about a laundry. So far I have washed everything myself, including the sheets which I lay out to dry upon the lawn. Perhaps I will continue to do this. There is a remarkable satisfaction in the performance of these simple tasks. I forgot to record that I have found a second shop in the village, a sort of ironmonger's, in the row of cottages behind the pub. It calls itself the Fisherman's Stores, and no doubt did once sell gear to the fishermen. This place, I discovered this morning, supplies paraffin and calagas. I also purchased from them some candles, a new oil lamp, and a length of rope. Carrying these trophies, I dropped into the Black Lion on the way home. The bar there falls silent when I enter and bursts into raucous chatter when I leave. But I propose to make a habit of coming, nonetheless. The mild hostility of the villagers does not worry me. Of course, thanks to television, they know who I am. But they have been at pains to exhibit indifference, and indeed, in all their worthy simplicity, they may even be indifferent. For them, I am perhaps something unreal, touched by the unreality of the medium itself. No one, thank God, has attempted to befriend me. For lunch, I ate the kipper fillets rapidly unfrozen in boiling water. The sun had done most of the work, garnished with lemon juice, oil, and a light sprinkling of dry herbs. Kipper fillets are arguably better than smoked salmon, unless the latter is very good. With these fried-tinned new potatoes, no real new potatoes yet. Potatoes are for me a treat dish, not a dull, everyday chaperone. Then Welsh rabbit and hot beetroot. The shop sliced bread is less than great, but all right toasted, with good salty New Zealand butter. Fortunately, I like a wide variety of those crackly Scandinavian biscuits which are supposed to make you thin. Of course they do not. If you are destined to be fat, food makes you fat. But I have never had a weight problem. Now that I own land, I must have a herb garden. A supply of fresh herbs has always been a problem of my life as an enlightened eater. Of course, the notion of growing herbs never entered my head as a child in my parents' garden. I suspect children cannot understand food. But where am I to put it? I hesitate to dig up either of my little lawns, and anyway they are rather too close to the sea. If I were to make myself a secret allotment on the other side of the road, would some peasant or animal rob it? I must reflect on these things. Happy and innocent reflections, so unlike the agonizings of the past. After lunch, I cut off a length of my rope and tied it onto the iron banister of the tower's steps. Now it trails handily into the sea, moving darkened in the waves. I've knotted the seaward end for easier grasp. I've had less success with the cliff, for the simple reason that there is nothing here to attach the rope to. The rocks are too humpy and smooth, and the rope is not long enough to reach the house. Buy a longer piece, and attach it to the kitchen door, or to the post at the bottom of the stairs, and haul the long wet end into the kitchen every night? These problems, too, are not without interest. The rope itself is beautiful stuff, lightly burnished and smelling like retsina. I am told it is made locally. I spent part of the afternoon lying upon my rock bridge, between the house and the tower, and watching the waves coming flying through beneath me and killing themselves in fits of rage in the deep enclosed rocky area on the inland side. The sight of the rushing, foaming water made me feel, after a while, almost light-headed, as if I might have become giddy and fallen in. Most enjoyable. I am a bit dismayed, however, to find, from studying the picture postcards in the shop, that my bridge and its whirlpool are well-known local features. Fortunately, the cards seemed rather old and crumpled, and I bought up the entire stock for less than a pound. I want no trippers here seeking for a beauty spot. In fact, the bridge is nothing much, just a hump of rock with a hole in it, and an open pit beyond. At certain states of the tide, the water, forcing itself through, produces a loud, hollow report. I hope this does not draw attention to the place. I learned from the cards that the enclosed whirlpool is called Min's Cauldron. I asked the shop lady who Min was, but she didn't know. Statements made by distant church bells remind me it is Sunday. Today the sky has become cloudy. I've been watching the clouds, and it occurs to me that I have never done this in my life before, simply sit and watch clouds. As a child, I would have been far too anxious to waste time in this way, and my mother would have stopped me. As I write this, I'm sitting on my plot of grass behind the house, where I have put a chair, cushions, rugs. It is evening. Thick, lumpy, slate-blue clouds, their bulges lit up to a lighter blue, move slowly across a sky of muddy and yet brilliant gold, a sort of dulled gilt effect. At the horizon there is a light, glittering, slightly jagged silver line. like modern jewellery. Beneath it, the sea is alive, choppy, lyrical, goldeny brown, jumping with white flecks. The air is warm. Another happy day. "Whatever will you do down there?" they asked. In a quiet, surreptitious way, I'm feeling very pleased with myself. Another day. I have decided not to put dates, as they break up the sense of a continuous meditation. I have been rereading the opening pages of my autobiography. How full, for me at any rate, of frightful resonance those statements are which I have made, with such an odd and sudden air of authority, about my childhood. I had never thought of myself as being that much interested. I had intended to write about Clement. Do I really want to describe my childhood? I have not swum today. I went to the tower steps in the afternoon intending to swim, but found to my annoyance that the rope which I had fixed to the banister had somehow become untied and floated away. I'm not very good at knots. In any case, that rope is perhaps too thick to knot easily. It occurs to me that a long piece of nylon cloth might be more serviceable. Felt a little depressed, but was cheered up by supper, spaghetti with a little butter and dried basil. Basil is, of course, the king of herbs. Then spring cabbage cooked slowly with dill. Boiled onions served with bran, herbs, soya oil, and tomatoes, with one egg beaten in. With these, a slice or two of cold-tinned corned beef. Meat is really just an excuse for eating vegetables. I drank a bottle of Retsina in honour of the undeserving rope. It is now late at night, and I am sitting upstairs with one of my old oil lamps and the new lamp. The new one gives a less beautiful light, but it is easier to carry. I must get more of these lamps, though I suppose I shall never be able to dispense with candles. Mrs. Chorney left me about a dozen candlesticks, handy, though not things of beauty, and I have placed these, complete with candles and matches, at strategic positions throughout the house. The smell of the new lamp reminds me of Fritzy. I shall now continue my autobiography. I was born at Stratford-upon-Avon, or, to be exact, near it, or, to be more exact, in the Forest of Arden. I grew up in leafy central England, as far as it is possible to be in this island from the sea. I did not see the sea until I was 14. Of course, I owe my whole life to Shakespeare. If I had not lived close to a great theatre, indeed close to that great theatre, I would never have managed to see any plays. My parents never went to the theatre. My mother positively disapproved of it. There was little enough spare money for going out anywhere, and we never went out. I did not go to a restaurant until after I left school. I did not enter a hotel till later still. For holidays we went to Shaxton, or to Ramsden's, or to the farm where my mother had worked as a secretary. I would never have gone to a theatre at all if it had not been that Shakespeare was work. A master at the school was Shakespeare mad. That man, too, made my life. His name was Mr. McDowell. We went to the plays often. We saw everything. Sometimes Mr. McDowell paid for me. And, of course, we acted plays, too. Mr. McDowell was stage-struck, an acteur manqué. I became his stage-struck pet. It was he who took me and some other boys to the sea in Wales for a week. I think this was one of the most important and happy weeks I have ever spent. Happy hardly expresses it. I was nearly insane with joy the whole time. My mother accepted the theatre-going because it was part of my schoolwork. I even cunningly pretended that I did not really enjoy it. It was just necessary for my exam. Wicked lying little boy. I was in heaven. My father knew, but we would never have confessed to each other that we were deceiving my mother. My father was a quiet, bookish man, and somehow the gentlest being I have ever encountered. I do not mean he was timid, though I suppose he was timid. He had a positive moral quality of gentleness. I can picture him now so clearly, bending down with his perpetual nervous smile to pick up a spider on a piece of paper and put it carefully out of the window or into some corner of the house where it would not be disturbed. I was his comrade, his reading companion, possibly the only person with whom he ever had a serious conversation. I always felt that we were in the same boat, adventuring along together. We read the same books and discussed them. Children's books, adventure stories, then novels, history, biography, poetry, Shakespeare. We enjoyed and craved for each other's company. What a test that is. More than devotion, admiration, passion. If you long and long for someone's company, you love them. I remember feeling in later life that no one else ever knew how good my father was. I doubt if even my mother knew. Of course I loved my mother, too, but she had a hard line in her where my father had none. She believed in a just God. Perhaps this belief supported her through what may have proved a somewhat disappointing life. The trouble with my parents, at least from my point of view, was that they did not want to go anywhere or do anything. My mother disapproved of going anywhere or doing anything, partly because this involved spending money, and partly because of the worldly vanities which any such removal might lead us to encounter. My father did not want to go anywhere or do anything, partly because my mother was against it, and partly because of his timidity and a certain indolence of character. I may have made it sound as if my father was a sad man, but this was not so. He understood the pleasures of the simple life and how to look forward to little treats. He did his dull office work diligently, I am sure, and did odd jobs about the house with zeal. He enjoyed his reading, which, when he was not partaking in my education, tended to be novels and adventure stories. I can remember him, when he was fatally ill, reading Treasure Island with a magnifying glass. He loved and cherished my mother and me. And there his world ended. He was not interested in politics, or travel, or any form of entertainment, or even any form of art other than literature. He had no friends, except me. It may be mentioned that he liked his brother Abel, though just how much, I was never sure. He never entirely got on with my cousin James, because he saw him as a rival to me. Aunt Estelle embarrassed him. My mother detested the lot of them, but behaved very well in spite of it. I went into the theatre, of course, because of Shakespeare. Those who knew me in later years as a Shakespeare director often did not realise how absolutely this God had directed me from the very first. I had, of course, other motives. From the guileless simplicity of my parents' life, from the immobility and quietness of my home, I fled to the trickery and magic of art. I craved glitter, movement, aerobatics, noise. I became an expert on flying machines. I arranged fights. I always took, as my critics said, an almost childish, almost excessive delight in the technical trickery of the theatre. I also took up acting, and was conscious of this too from the beginning, because I wanted to have fun myself and to procure some for my father. I doubt if he possessed the concept, or ever managed to acquire it later under my eager guidance. In having fun myself, I have, throughout my life, been fairly consistently successful. I was much less successful in persuading my parents to enjoy themselves. Eventually, I took them to Paris, to Venice, to Athens. They were always thoroughly uneasy and longing to get home, though I think it may later have given them some satisfaction to think that they had been to these places. They really wanted to remain always in their own house and their own garden. There are such people. I was a docile, quiet, loving child, but I knew that a great fight was coming, and I wanted to win it, and win it quickly. I did both. When I was 17, my father wanted me to go to the university. My mother did too, though she feared the expense. Instead, I went to an acting school in London. I obtained a scholarship. Mr. McDowell had not laboured in vain. One of the saddest things in my life was crossing my dear father in this. But I could not wait. My mother was appalled. She thought that the theatre was an abode of sin. She was right. And she thought that I would never succeed and would return home starving. She despised people who could not earn their living. Here she was not right, and at least as the years went by she could not help respecting my ability to make money. The theatre then and thenceforth became my home. I even spent the war acting, since a patch on the lung, which cleared up soon after, kept me out of the armed forces. I was rather sorry about this later on. Mr. Arkwright, do you ever see any very large eels in this vicinity?
Direct speech.
I record what I said this morning in the Black Lion, where I was buying some of the local cider. The cider is unfortunately too sweet, and I shall before long have exhausted the modest supply of wine which I brought with me. The Black Lion has, of course, never heard of wine, but the intelligent shop lady tells me that the Raven Hotel sells real wine. The Black Lion landlord's name, Arkwright, disturbs me with memories of a chauffeur of that name whom I once had when I was a grandee, and who regarded me with rancorous hatred. The relation between the chauffeur and the chauffeured can be curiously intense. Black Lion Arkwright is, in fact, fairly disturbing in his own right. He is a big fellow with long black hair and black whiskers, like a sort of Victorian cad. He leads the bar in the game of embarrassing me. He now analyzes my question. Eels? Large? Very large? Vicinity? "Do you mean on land?" he asks. "He means worms," says one of the clients. The clients are almost always the same. Retired farm labourers, I imagine. No women, of course. "I mean eels in the sea." All shake their heads gloomily. "Wouldn't see them in the sea, would you? They'd be underwater," someone offers. Someone else adds darkly, "Eels is no good." The question drops. I return home carrying pointless cider purchased out of politeness. I have had one success, however. The little upstairs room facing the road, on the inner room and drawing-room side, sported a pair of stout cotton curtains. I should add that the corresponding front window on the other side is that of the bathroom. I have cut one of these curtains down the middle, knotted the two ends, and tied this rope onto the iron banister at the steps, thereby enabling myself to have an excellent swim this morning at low tide, even though the sea was choppy. Lunch, frankfurters with scrambled eggs, grilled tomatoes and a slight touch of garlic, then shop treacle tart, squeezed with lemon juice and covered with yoghurt and thick cream. I drank some of the cider just to spite it. After lunch I started to make a border round my lawn with the prettiest stones which I have collected. I cannot decide whether or not it looks ridiculous. A rather cloudy day and a cool breeze with a strange coffee-coloured light over the sea. Towards evening, the usual cloud show. Great cliffs and headlands of light golden-brown cloud build up to majestic heights with a froth of pure gold clinging to their huge sides. I tried to light a fire of driftwood in the little red room, but the chimney smoked again. I have been cleaning and tidying up the house. What an extraordinary satisfaction there is in cleaning things. Does the satisfaction depend on ownership? I suspect so. I swept the hall and stairs. I washed the big slate flagstones in the kitchen. Very rewarding. I also washed the big ugly vase on the landing and polished the battered rosewood table. It was grateful. I started to dust the drawing-room chimney-piece, but some spirit that dwelt therein resisted me. And I have now been polishing the big oval mirror in the hall, which I think I mentioned before. This fine thing, date 1890... is perhaps the best piece in the house. The glass is beveled and somewhat spotted, but remarkably luminous and silvery, so that the mirror seems like a source of light. The frame is made of a dullish grey metal, pewter, and represents a sort of swirling garland of leaves and branches and berries. Metal polish brought a little more luminosity and detail into this metal vegetation. A lot of dirt certainly came off on the cloth. Since I have just spent a little while gazing at myself in this mirror, it is perhaps time to attempt to describe my appearance. This may seem superfluous. Yes, of course, I have been a much photographed man, but the camera has never been entirely my friend. How fortunate that I never wanted to be a film star. Let me describe the real me. I am slim and of medium build. I have an oval face with a short, straight nose and thin lips, and a uniformly fair, fine complexion which is given to blushing. If annoyed or affronted, I blush scarlet. This habit, which used to worry me, later became a kind of trademark. And when I became known in my profession as a Tartar, it was inadvertently useful in frightening people. My eyes are a rather pale, chilly blue. I wear small, oval, rimless spectacles for reading. I have light, rather colourless, straight, fair hair, not worn long. This, never brilliant, fades and dims, but does not go grey. I have decided not to dye it. A few years ago, when my hair began to recede, I enlisted the aid of science with entirely satisfactory results. I should say that what the camera fails to catch is the fine, almost girlish texture of my, of course, clean-shaven face, and its somewhat ironical and wily expression. Not to beat about the bush, it is a clever face. Photographers can too easily make one look a fool. I often think I resemble my father, and yet he looked both gentle and simple, whereas I look neither. To bed early with a hot water bottle. Very tired. I think it is not going to be too easy to write about the theatre. Perhaps my reflections on that vast subject will make another book. I had better get straight on to Clement Makin. After all, it is for Clement that I am here. This was her country. She grew up on this lonely coast. We never visited it. Was I superstitious? Her Ultima Thule bided its hour. Clement was my first mistress. When we met, I was 20, she was 39, or said she was. Partly because of someone I had loved and lost, and partly because of my Puritan upbringing, I remained a virgin until Clement swooped like an eagle. Was she a great actress? Yes, I think so. Of course, women act all the time. It is easier to judge a man. Wilfrid, for instance. I shall have to talk a bit about the theatre, simply to give Clement her context, to dress the scene for her to sweep upon. She was not like what people thought. Neither her fans nor her foes did her justice, and she had her lion's share of both. She always fought mercilessly for those she loved, and then she became totally immoral. She lied and cheated for them. She trampled upon rights and upon hearts. She loved me, and I am quite prepared to admit that, as it happened, she made me. Though I would have made myself anyway. God rest her restless soul. Emotions really exist at the bottom of the personality, or at the top. In the middle, they are acted. This is why all the world is a stage, and why the theatre is always popular, and indeed why it exists. Why it is like life, and it is like life even though it is also the most vulgar and outrageously factitious of all the arts. Even a middling novelist can tell quite a lot of truth. His humble medium is on the side of truth, whereas the theatre, even at its most realistic, is connected with the level at which, and the methods by which, we tell our everyday lies. This is the sense in which ordinary theatre resembles life, and dramatists are disgraceful liars unless they are very good. On the other hand, in a purely formal sense, the theatre is the nearest to poetry of all the arts. I used to think that if I could have been a poet, I would never have bothered with the theatre at all, but of course this was nonsense. What I needed with all my starved and silent soul was just that particular way of shouting back at the world. The theatre is an attack on mankind, carried on by magic, to victimize an audience every night, to make them laugh and cry and suffer and miss their trains. Of course, actors regard audiences as enemies, to be deceived, drugged, incarcerated, stupefied. This is partly because the audience is also a court against which there is no appeal. Art's relation with its client is here as its closest and most immediate. In other arts, we can blame the client. He is stupid, unsophisticated, inattentive, dull. But the theatre must, if need be, stoop, and stoop until it attains that direct, that universal communication which other artists can afford to seek more deviously and at their ease. Hence the assault, the noise, the characteristic impatience. All this was part of my revenge. How vulgar, how almost cruel it all was. I gloatingly savour now that I am absolutely out of it at last, now that I can sit in the sun and look at the calm, quiet sea. This solitude and quiet, after all that babble, after all that garish row, a deep, undynamic stillness so unlike the fine dramatic silences of the theatre. Tempest Scene 2, or the entry of Peter Pan. So unlike, too, the strange, familiar, and yet exciting hush of an empty theatre. Actors are cave-dwellers in a rich darkness which they love and hate. How I enjoyed rending expectant silences with noise, noise as structure, noise as colour. I once directed a thriller which began with a long silence, and then a scream. That sound became famous. Yet, or perhaps consequently, I do not care greatly for music. Noise, yes. Music, no. I admire the intricate and essentially silent musical drama of ballet, but opera I detest. Clement used to say this was a case of envy. I must admit, I envy Wagner. The theatre is a place of obsession. It is not a soft dreamland. Unemployment, poverty, disappointment, racking indecision, take this now and miss that later, grind reality into one's face, and, as in family life, one soon learns the narrow limitations of the human soul. Yet obsession is what it is all about. All good dramatists and directors, and most, not all, good actors are obsessed men. Only geniuses like Shakespeare conceal the fact, or rather, change it into something spiritual. And obsession drives to hard work. I myself have always worked, and worked others, like a demon. My mother's training made me a compulsive worker. She was never idle, and she did not tolerate idleness in others. My father enjoyed a certain amount of fixing and mending, but he would have liked to sit, sometimes quite vacantly, and watch the world drift by. Only he was never allowed to. My mother was not ambitious for him in a worldly sense. She scorned the successful world of Uncle Abel and Aunt Estelle, though I think that the prospect of it always hurt her in some obscure way. She simply wanted my father to be always usefully employed. Fortunately, discussing books with me counted as useful. She did not profess to understand his office work. She showed no curiosity about it, and I suspect she had no idea what he did. She organized him at home. She also organized me, but this was easy because I was only too ready to be obsessively industrious. Journalists have often asked me how it was that I first started to write plays. I did not, as has been unkindly suggested, turn to writing out of disappointment with my career as an actor. I started to write when I was still quite young, because I could not bear to waste time when I was unemployed. I early saw the demoralization of so many of my out-of-work companions. Resting is one of the least restful periods of an actor's life. Those times were also, of course, my university. I read, and I wrote, and I taught myself my trade. Since there has been quite a lot of uninformed and not always unmalicious speculation on the subject, let me now say something about my plays. They were always intended to be ephemeral, rather like pantomimes, in fact, and they existed only in my direction of them. I never let anyone else touch them. Unless one is very talented indeed, there is no resting place between the naive and the ironic, and the nemesis of irony is absurdity. I knew my limitations. The plays were also said to be only vehicles for Wilfred Dunning. Why only? Wilfred was a great actor. They do not make them like Wilfred any more. He started his career in the old music hall in the Edgware Road. He could stand motionless, not moving an eyelid, and make a theatre rock with prolonged laughter. Then he would blink and set them off again. Such power can be almost uncanny. The mystery of the human body, the human face. Wilfred had a face which glowed with spirit. He also had, with the possible exception of Peregrine Arbelot, the largest face I have ever seen. It is true that he was, in a sense, the only begetter of my work as a dramatist, and when he died I stopped writing. I can say without regret that my plays belong to the past, and I bequeath them to no one. They were magical delusions, fireworks. Only this, which I write now, is, or foreshadows, what I wish to leave behind me as a lasting memorial. Someone once said that I ought to have been a choreographer, and I understood the comment. People were surprised that I was so popular in Japan, but I knew why, and the Japanese knew. Though described as an experimentalist, I am a firm friend of the proscenium arch. I am in favour of illusion, not of alienation. I detest the endless fidgeting on the surrounded stage which dissolves the clarity of events. Equally, I abhor the nonsense of audience participation. Riots and other communal activities may have their value, but must not be confused with dramatic art. Drama must create a factitious, spellbinding present moment and imprison the spectator in it. The theatre apes the profound truth that we are extended beings who yet can only exist in the present. It is a factitious present because it lacks the free aura of personal reflection and contains its own secret limits and conclusions. Thus, life is comic. But though it may be terrible, it is not tragic. Tragedy belongs to the cunning of the stage. Of course, most theatre is gross, ephemeral rot, and only plays by great poets can be read, except as director's notes. I say great poets, but I suppose I really mean Shakespeare. It is a paradox that the most essentially frivolous and rootless of all the serious arts has produced the greatest of all writers, that Shakespeare was quite different from the others, not just primus inter pares, but totally different in quality, was something which I discovered entirely by myself when I was still at school, and on this secret was I nourished. There are no other plays on paper, unless one counts the Greek plays. I cannot read Greek, and James tells me these are untranslatable. After looking at a number of translations, I am sure he is right. Of course, the theatre is essentially a place of hopes and disappointments, and in its cyclical life one lives out in a more vivid way the cyclical patterns of the ordinary world. The thrill of a new play, the shock of a flop, the weariness of a long run, the homeless feeling when it ends. Perpetual construction followed by perpetual destruction. It is to do with endings, with partings, with packings up and dismantlings and the disbanding of family groups. All this makes theatre people into nomads, or rather into the separated members of some sort of monastic order where certain natural feelings, the desire for permanence, for instance, have to be suppressed. We have the heartlessness of monks, and in this respect we suffer the changes characteristic of ordinary life with a difference, in a sublimated, symbolic way. As actor, director, and playwright, I have, of course, had my full share of disappointments, of lost time and lost ways. My successful career contains many failures, many dead ends. All my plays flopped on Broadway, for instance. I failed as an actor. I ceased as a playwright. Only my fame as a director has covered up these facts. If absolute power corrupts absolutely, then I must be the most corrupt of men. A theatre director is a dictator. If he is not doing his job. I fostered my reputation for ruthlessness. It was extremely useful. Actors expected tears and nervous prostration when I was around. Most of them loved it. They are masochists as well as narcissists. I well remember Gilbert Opian, hysterical and enjoying every moment. Of course, the girls wept all the time. When, advanced in my career, I directed Clement, we both wept. My God, how we fought! I was always merciless to drunks, and this did strain my relations with Peregrine Arbelow even before the Rosina business. Perry is an Irish drunk, the worst kind. Wilfred drank like a fish, but it never showed on stage. Christ, I miss him. I liked that handy picture of myself as a tartar. Other publicized conceptions of me have been uglier and more misleading. I never used my power to haul girls into bed. Of course, the theatre is all that my mother thought, and a great deal that the poor dear could not have conceived of. Yet also it must be remembered that the theatre is a profession, and many perfectly typical actors are middle-aged men who are regularly supplied with work and who live faithfully with wives and families in suburbs. Such persons are the backbone of the trade. Of course, the theatre is sex, 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 but how much does the subject matter affect the professional? My mother was upset at the thought of my acting bad people, because she thought this would corrupt me. In fact, except in school plays, she hardly ever saw me act. I wonder if such corruption ever occurs. The question is worth asking. To some extent, one has to identify with villains in order to portray them, but there are limits to this identification, partly because wickedness is so specialized. Every actor has a level at which he cannot portray character. He may operate above it or below it. And we are masked figures. Ideally, the masks barely touch us. Such is my view, with which some fools will differ. I recall a story of an old actor asked to portray an old man who said with dismay, "But I've never played an old man." That was professionalism. But to return to myself, I dare say, an unfashionable thing to say nowadays, I am not very highly sexed. I can live perfectly well without sexual relations. Some observers have even thought I must be homosexual because I did not have perpetual mistresses. I hate mess. Perhaps my morally hygienic mother somehow taught me to. And I have never liked the complicit male world of foul-mouthed talk and bawdy. Of course I have had not a few love affairs, but I never bribed a woman into bed. Someone, Rosina, once said, "You care about the theatre more than you care about women." And it was true. I never, except for once when I was young, seriously considered marriage. I loved once, the same once, absolutely. Then there was Clement, eternal, wonderful, unclassifiable Clement. And I have been madly infatuated. And there have been, oh, such sweet girls. But I am not a womanizer. I have always been a dedicated professional. I was in this respect harsh with myself as well as with others. Silly, messy love affairs, especially within a closed group, interfere with serious work. I am very prone to jealousy myself, and I have mixed with very jealous people. Envy has always troubled me less. Crippling envy can be a terrible disability in the theatre, and I early realized that to overcome it was a prerequisite of success. Was I sorry that I never became a first-rate actor? How often I have been asked that question. Well, of course. Directors always envy actors, and I suspect that almost every great director would secretly prefer to be a great actor. Some people held the view that a more successful acting career awaited me in films and television, and they tried to lure me in. But in spite of many amusing excursions, I never cared much for these media. I always felt real drama belonged to the live theatre. I had my ambitions, especially, of course, in Shakespeare, but I always funked Lear, and the less said about my Hamlet, the better. I think I was a good Prospero, that time when Lizzie was Ariel. That was my last great part, and now so long ago. After that I laid a certain vanity aside. Vanity receives such a battering in the theatre, one would imagine that it would tend to vanish, but most actors manage to retain theirs, not only as an occupational ailment, but perhaps actually as a necessary instrument of survival. Genuine, generous admiration, and there is plenty of it, always helps and heals. I looked at the good actors, and the great actors, at Wilfrid, at Sidney Ash, at Marcus Henty, also one of Clement's lovers, at Fabian Ginsberg, even at Perry, even at Al. And as an actor, I quietly took a back seat. This was easier to do by then, as I was fully absorbed in directing. I amused myself and the public by playing tiny parts in my own productions, and once nearly stole the show as Jacob in The Seagull. Well, I seem to be writing everything down all at once in a sort of jumble. Perhaps I should indeed regard this diary as rough notes. I shall resist, for the present at any rate, the temptation to reminisce about my productions. I am known as a Shakespeare man, but of course I have tried my hand at everything. You name it, I did it. And so, enough of boasting. These ramblings were to introduce Clement Makin. But poor Clement can wait. Indeed, she cannot choose but wait. That great battle of wills is finished forever, and I sit here and wonder at myself. Have I abjured that magic, drowned my book, forgiven my enemies? The surrender of power, the final change of magic into spirit? Time will show. Something rather odd and distressing has just occurred. I wrote the above sitting outside on my lawn on my stone seat beside my trough of stones. As the morning sun became hot, I decided to go inside and fetch my sun hat. I have a slight headache. Possibly I need new glasses. I went into the house and up the stairs, blinking in the comparative gloom, and when I reached the upper landing, I was at once aware that something had happened, although I could not understand what. Then I realized that my lovely, big, ugly vase was gone from its pedestal. It had fallen onto the floor and was broken into a great many pieces. But how? The pedestal is perfectly steady and has not moved. There has been no wind. The bead curtain is motionless. Perhaps I shifted the vase very slightly when I dusted it yesterday. Or has there been an earth tremor? I am reluctant to think that I am to blame, and I am sure I am not. I liked the poor, ugly thing. It was like an old dog. I picked up the pieces, thinking vaguely of mending it, but of course that would be impossible. How can it have jumped off its stand? I am totally puzzled. But all your letters are in the dog kennel, Mr. Arabi. I had broken down at last and asked at the post office. I say broken down not so much because I was thereby losing face with the village, though that too was in my mind, as because I was losing face with myself. Why should I now need letters, or miss them, or pine for them, or be surprised if nobody wrote to me? I had already arranged with Miss Kaufman for business letters to be kept in London. Only letters from friends were to be sent on, and as I was explaining to myself, really I have no friends. But there was one letter which I was interested in having, which at least I was expecting. However, let us return for the moment to this dog kennel. "Dog kennel," I said to the post office lady. She is the sister of the shop lady, the post office being part of the shop. "Yes, the stone dog kennel just before you go across to your house. Mrs. Chawney always had her letters put in there." This object, the road end of the causeway, pointed out to me by the house agent as the boundary of my land, I had, of course, noticed, but not investigated. It was quite big, and had indeed the form of a dog kennel, but one which, in my opinion, would be suitable only for a stone dog. I imagine it had originally had some other purpose, though I cannot think what. I protested. How was I to know? Was I supposed to guess? Why had someone not told me? Why did the postman not notice that no letters had been picked up? What happened when it rained? And so on. The post office lady repeated with dignity that Mrs. Chawney had always had her mail in the dog kennel, that it saved the postman a walk, that he could not be expected to peer inside to see if letters had gone, and anyhow I might be away, and so on. I bought some frozen coley, much better than cod, and hurried home. Yes, the letter I was waiting for, together with various other missives, was in the dog kennel, which would be swimming with water in rainy weather, and I carried the lot into the house. The letter I wanted was from Lizzie Shearer, and when I transcribe it, it will become clear in what respect I have been less than frank with this diary. In fact, I have been disinclined to discuss Lizzie earlier because I was not sure what I felt about something which I had recently done about her. Not that I was upset or anxious. When I came here, I decided that I would never be anxious any more about personal relations. Such anxiety is too often a form of vanity. What I had done was to send Lizzie a letter which constituted a sort of test, or game, or gamble. A serious game. I had always played serious games with Lizzie. Did I regret sending the letter? Do I? Will I regret it? Well, a word first, perhaps, about the girl herself. Clement Makin was, or was nearly, a great actress. Lizzie Shearer is, at the other end of the scale, very nearly not an actress at all. In so far as Lizzie was ever successful, I made her so. I stretched her beyond her limits, and I may as well confess now that I took trouble with Lizzie because, in a way, I loved her. I say, in a way, not only because I have only really loved once, and Lizzie was not it, but also because I found it surprisingly easy to leave her when the time came. I was never mad about Lizzie, as I have occasionally been about other women, Rosina, Jean. I cared for her in a quiet, rather dreamy way, which was perhaps unique in my life. But I left her. She loved me far more intensely. For Lizzie, I was it. Lizzie is Scottish, half Sephardi Jew. Although she has the most adorable breasts of any woman I ever made love to, she is not really beautiful, and never was, even when she was young. But she has charm. This fetching charm, and her youth, while it lasted, took her a little way in the theatre. She was a hard worker, and had a kind of steady Scottish reliability which always helped. Her appearance is not easy to describe. She has a large, wide brow and a strong, attractive profile. One can fall in love with a profile. The line of her brow runs down in a smooth line curve into a smallish, pretty nose which speeds forward at the world without quite turning up. Then there is a straight line to a firm chin wherein there is the faintest dimple. Her lips are firm too, not full, but well-moulded and sensitively textured. How different individual lips are! Nature, not art, has painted them an attractive terracotta pink. Her upper lip is long and beautifully indented. Is there any language in which there is a word for that tender runnel that joins the mouth and the nose? One would call hers a clever face if it were not for a kind of childish timidity which hangs about it. I suspect that this gentle, pleading diffidence is Liz's charm. Her eyes are a light, dewy brown. When I kissed her, how those pale eyes flashed. She is short-sighted and tends to peer. As Peregrine once said, very few pretty women can see anything, since vanity precludes glasses. She has almost invisible orange eyebrows, which she never, under my regime, tampered with. Her complexion is healthy, rosy, rather shiny. She wears very little make-up, and lacks, perhaps makes a point of lacking, the wonderful artificiality of many theatre ladies, their enamelled, lacquered surfaces. This artificiality, of course, attracts. It attracted me. I like art in a woman's looks, though I do not necessarily want to see all the working. Liz's hair, now tinted, is a cinnamon brown, of the hyacinthine variety, and copious. It is a bit fuzzy, and grows more in screwy tendrils than in curls. When she is happy, her face is conspicuously radiant and merry. At her best on the stage, her face could make audiences sigh with pleasure. She is still quite good-looking, though she has allowed herself to become untidy and out of condition. Any drama school teaches physical discipline. Acting is a physical discipline. The ladies of the theatre tend to keep themselves sleek and youthful. And this Lizzie has failed to do. Nor was she ever smart. I am not indifferent to the unique pleasure afforded by a smart woman. And with advancing years, she has not, to put too fine a point upon it, got fat. My God, she must now be getting on for 50. Well, here, retrieved from the dog kennel, is Lizzie's letter, which will be, to some extent, self-explanatory. My dear, your beautiful, generous letter has come, but I don't understand it. Perhaps I don't want to understand it. It is enough to have it. When I saw your writing, I felt faint with joy and fear. But why fear? What have I ever done to you except love you? When I read your letter, I cried and cried. I wonder if you know how long it is since you wrote me anything better than a postcard. I almost feel as if I simply want to be happy ever after because you have written to me, not to have to think about your letter, or to answer it. For now I am falling into anxiety and dread. What do you want, Charles? Oh, you are so present to my mind as I write. But you have always been present to my mind ever since I first loved you. You live in my mind. Something about your letter that made me especially glad is that you do not doubt that I still love you. Still, hardly has meaning here. My love for you exists in a sort of eternal present. It almost is the meaning of time. I don't protest too much. Such love can live with despair, with quietness, with resignation, with ordinariness and tiredness and silence. I love you, Charles, and I will love you till I die, and you can put that away in your heart and be utterly certain of it. Your letter is so cool. Purposely cool and full of jokes, all that about wanting a nurse. All right, you would like to see me. Why not? We are old friends. But these two particular old friends cannot just say hello. At least this one cannot. I look at your letter, and I try to read between the lines. What is between the lines? I feel I am supposed to guess your mood. Oh, God, your mood. Do you want me to drop in for a short love affair? Please excuse these awful words, but you have put me in an awful situation. Perhaps your letter means very little, and I am imagining things. Perhaps you yourself do not know what you mean and don't care. That would be like you, too. Forgive me. Listen, Charles, I have said I am grateful, and I am. For years and years, as you know, I would have married you if you had crooked your finger, and I proposed to you every day when we were together.